Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Rush against Savchuk. Adamson, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case comes before this court on appeal from a judgment of the Supreme Court of the State of Minnesota. The issue presented by this appeal, succinctly stated, is whether or not the Minnesota courts may exercise constitutionally permissible quasi and rem jurisdiction over a non-resident tortfeasor who has absolutely no minimum contacts whatsoever with the state of Minnesota by permitting the plaintiff to garnish the defendant's liability insurance policy on the basis that the defendant's insurer does business within the state of Minnesota. That's the issue presented by this appeal. The operative facts are very simple, but they provide, I think, the necessary background. Back in 1972, Mr. Rush and Mr. Savchuk were involved in an automobile accident in Indiana. At that time, both Mr. Rush and Mr. Savchuk were residents and citizens of the state of Indiana. About a year and a half later, Mr. Savchuk decides to emigrate to Minnesota, and about a year after that, he commenced this lawsuit against Mr. Rush by serving a garnishment summons on State Farm, Mr. Rush's liability insurer in the state of Minnesota. I might say that Mr. Rush's liability insurer, State Farm, is his liability insurer by reason of a contract of insurance which was written and issued in the state of Indiana. No point of contact with any of these activities at all until Mr. Savchuk going to Minnesota and then commencing this action. As soon as this was done, Rush and State Farm immediately challenged the jurisdictional basis of the garnishment quasi and rem jurisdiction by appropriate motion, and the Minnesota District Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court found no due process problems whatsoever with the procedure. We then appealed to this court, and this court vacated the judgment of the Minnesota Supreme Court and remanded it back to the Minnesota Supreme Court with directions to reconsider their prior determination in light of Schaefer versus Heitner. The Minnesota Supreme Court duly reconsidered the matter and found no problem whatsoever with the quasi and rem jurisdiction in this case and felt that Schaefer versus Heitner did not change a thing. This second appeal followed, and this court noted probable jurisdiction. Now, before talking about Schaefer a little bit, I'd like to express to the court my understanding of the reasoning followed by the Minnesota Supreme Court in ignoring Schaefer.
What?
Ignoring, I say. Maybe that's an inappropriate word, distinguishing it.
Misunderstanding.
I would like to use that word, yes, sir. First of all, and I think that's rather interesting, the Minnesota Supreme Court, after talking about the facts in Schaefer, said that it considered the decision unclear. It also said that Minnesota's interest in facilitating recoveries for resident plaintiffs, notice that language, facilitating recoveries for resident plaintiffs, not only requires a local forum in Minnesota, but may override traditional choice of law analysis. Now, it may be there that the Minnesota Supreme Court was mixing jurisdiction and choice of law, which we all have so much trouble with, but at any rate, that's what it said. And the Minnesota Supreme Court went on to say that Minnesota possesses sufficient contacts, without identifying them, and the due process is not violated in this quasi and rem action because of three things. Here they are. One, Notice was given to the defendant. It sure was. There's no doubt about that. Two, the defendant cannot be held liable for more than his policy limits in Minnesota, pursuant to this quasi-in-rem proceeding. And three, the procedure is available only to Minnesota residents. It is not available to non-residents. It's available to only Minnesota residents. Now, these are the three bases which the Minnesota Supreme Court enunciated as providing the due process basis for this quasi-in-rem proceeding that I have described.
Your brief indicates that this plaintiff has now moved out of the state of Minnesota.
Yes, he's emigrated again to Pennsylvania, so that means I think he's lived in three states in 6 years. Probably that isn't material, but it does illustrate how fluid our population is when we're trying to arrive at a constitutional nexus based upon the transitory residence of a plaintiff in a given state at a given time. Now, that isn't all Minnesota Supreme Court did. I think it added the frosting on the cake, really, because after having reasoned all of this and come to the conclusion that due process was satisfied, it really gave the coup de grace to Mr. Rush. It said that in this situation where Minnesota acquires jurisdiction of an out-of-state accident over a non-resident and so forth, it will apply Minnesota substantive law. We are not a choice of law. When they found, we not only do we have jurisdiction, but the choice of law decision we're going to make, we're going to apply Minnesota law to this accident because it's more favorable to the plaintiff. The consequences in this particular case is, Your Honors, that by so doing, the Minnesota Supreme Court would strip from Mr. Rush what is basically an absolute defense, the guest statute of Indiana, which was certainly applicable to him and Mr. Savchek at the time of the accident, and also would substitute a doctrine of comparative negligence for contributory negligence, and also would prevent this action from being dismissed by reason of the running of the statute of limitations. All of these things Mr. Savchek got by being able to invoke the quasi-in-rem jurisdiction of the Minnesota Supreme Court. Now,
you had a divided vote on the court.
I beg your pardon, sir?
You had a divided vote on the court.
Yes, the vote was 6-3.
Mr.
Justice Otis dissenting, Madam Justice Wall writing the majority opinion.
100 years ago, Minnesota didn't have a guest statute. Am I correct in assuming it still doesn't have one?
No, sir. Minnesota has never had a guest statute. Minnesota abhors guest statutes. Judiciary does.
And you also do not have a direct action statute, as Arkansas does.
Yes. No, we do not have a direct action statute. I believe only two or three states, Louisiana and Wisconsin, do, but Minnesota does not. Now, of course, in the last analysis, Schaefer versus Heitner is going to mean what this court tells us that it means. But our understanding of the teaching of Schaefer versus Heitner is very simple and very, very easy to comprehend. We do not agree with the Minnesota Supreme Court about the lack of clarity of the opinion. Seems to me the heart of Schaefer comes right out and says that the standard for determining whether the exercise of quasi-in-rem jurisdiction is consistent with due process is the minimum contact standards enunciated in International Shoe. And you look to International Shoe and you find out what are those minimum contacts. They are the relationship among the defendant, the forum, and the litigation. If you apply that yardstick to the instant case, you find two things immediately, and there can't be any argument about it, none whatsoever. There is absolutely no contact whatsoever between defendant Rush off over in Indiana and the state of Minnesota. None. And there is absolutely no, to my understanding, relationship between the litigation and the state of Minnesota. The only state in the union that has any meaningful contact with this litigation would be the state of Indiana, where everything happened. Or Mr. Savchek was allegedly injured and where he was made well. Thus, if you read Schaefer as I have and read International Shoe as I have just done, that's the end of it. There is no due process here in this quasi-in-rem basis. Now, the Minnesota court took a somewhat different view about these things. The Minnesota court, first of all, completely ignored the lack of relationship between the forum, the state of Minnesota, and the litigation. It snubbed that matter completely. And instead of that, it placed its primary emphasis not on the defendant, but upon the residency of the plaintiff. Now, it may well be that the state of Minnesota has an understandably strong public policy as enunciated by its courts to provide its residents with a forum. But that policy does not establish due process. It almost begs the question. Assuming such policy, you nevertheless must ask the question, does effecting that policy in this particular matter violate or not violate the due process clause?
I assume, I don't maybe I shouldn't, that your principal client is the insurance company rather than the individual, and there could be a conflict, I suppose, here. Now, what I wanted to know, though, is assume the individual involved here felt as a matter of principle he had no contact with Minnesota, and he didn't care what the Minnesota judge said. He just wasn't going to go up there and testify. He lives in Indiana. He wanted to stay home. Could the Minnesota judge hold him in contempt for refusing to respond to a notice to appear and testify in court?
Well, Mr. Justice Stevens, I'd like to answer that question in two parts. I do consider Mr. Rush both morally and ethically my client.
I don't mean to suggest any ethical problem, but there is an economic problem.
This is what would transpire if jurisdiction were allowed in this case and Mr. Rush would refuse to cooperate in his defense. I think that's the way we'd put it and so forth. A default judgment would be entered against him.
For the policy limits.
Yes.
But he could not be held in contempt of court.
No, sir.
So really it's in the nature of a suit against the insurance company on the policy.
Well, but if Mr. Rush were to avail himself of that privilege of not cooperating with his insurance company and what have you, there would be quite a problem about enforcing that judgment against the insurance company because of his breach of the insurance contract of cooperation.
Well, supposing he, at the outset of the litigation, said, I'm simply not going to go up to Minnesota, and if you want to terminate your coverage, go ahead and terminate it. And they terminate the coverage. Then there's no longer a basis for quasi-interim jurisdiction, is there?
Well, if I understand your hypothetical right, of course, the termination of coverage as of the time Mr. Rush told State Farm he didn't want any more to do with them would not affect the period of time when there was coverage, at which time the accident had happened.
But would it not extinguish their duty to defend?
No, sir.
Oh, they have a duty to defend even if he breaches his obligation to cooperate.
Even if he breaches his obligation to cooperate, yes, sir.
They then still have the duty to
yes.
defend. I see. So he could do that.
It's an anticipatory breach, as I understand it.
I see. But he could not, you would agree that he could not personally be subjected to any discipline or any court order by the judge in Minnesota.
There's not a shadow of my doubt in my mind about that, Mr. Justice Stevens. He could not be.
Well, there's not a shadow in your mind, doubt of your in your mind that the Minnesota court was wrong in this case either, as you've submitted to us. But what do you think the Minnesota courts would hold? The courts have held that they have personal jurisdiction over Mr. Rush, at least to the extent of the limits of liability on the insurance policy.
They have held that they have quasi and rem jurisdiction over Mr. Rush to the extent of liability policy.
Him.
There is no in personam jurisdiction in this case.
To enter a judgment against him to the extent of the limits of liability of his liability policy.
Mm-hmm. Then the next.
Don't you think it might follow in the view of the Minnesota court that the Minnesota court had a power to punish him for contempt for refusing to obey a subpoena?
No, Your Honor, Mr. Justice Stewart, I do not. There just is no basis for it. This
well,
is a
you
civil
think
action.
There's no basis for the Minnesota court opinion in this case.
No, there's. I want to answer your specific question. If we're getting off on this tangent here, this is a civil action. There is no process in the state of Minnesota that can require Mr. Savchuk to come there and testify.
Nothing more than a notice and a request.
Yeah, right? They can request him, but they can't subpoena him because of the limitation of state
law. And the penalty is a default judgment.
Default judgment, a civil penalty, which is imposed that way, but not to put him in jail or fine him or do something of that nature.
The judgment that may be entered against him is not a personal judgment, is it?
No,
I mean,
sir.
In the sense that it would... If they, the judgment's entered, it would not be enforceable against him in another state.
If we're talking about a default judgment, the answer to that is no. If we are talking about a judgment as a result of this case being litigated, I am not so sure.
Well, the judgment is entered, and the person who gets the judgment prefers to enforce it in Indiana.
Mr. Justice White, is this a default judgment or
no?
Or
it's after trial.
It's an adversary judgment.
And he's never shown up.
All right. Well, of course, I don't know why my friend over here would do such a thing when he's got the fat cat insurance company right there in Minnesota. Why would he want to run off?
Because he doesn't want to fight with you. He's just heard you say in court that if Rush doesn't show up, there may be a terrible problem of enforcing your liability on the policy.
But the point that you raised that hadn't occurred to me, I suppose if State Farm went bankrupt in the interim, he might go to Indiana looking for Mr. Rush.
Well, what's the basis for personal jurisdiction?
There isn't any. If I understand your question, Mr. Justice White.
That's the question I was, and I'm not quite sure I got your answer. Assume the company goes bankrupt.
Yeah.
Can he enforce the judgment against the individual?
I don't know. He might well try. It's a quasi in rem, but the asset supposedly is the policy, the race is the policy, so I suppose it wouldn't work. But we're off on this, and this is the court is touching on an area which is very disturbing to us. And that is, while Minnesota says, look, we will not enforce this judgment against Mr. Rush, the jury could come in for $1 million. The policy is $50,000. We will not enforce this judgment here in Minnesota for more than $50,000. And that's all very nice, because that's the amount of the insurance policy. What is to prevent somebody suing Mr. Rush anew someplace else where they can get some basis of jurisduction? Assuming
you would at least concede that you sue him on that judgment for over $50,000.
I don't know. Suppose it's $1 million judgment.
Well, suppose it is.
What if they rely on Park Lane hosiery?
He goes over to North Dakota and he says, I have a deficiency. You've got a gold mine over here. Well, you've had your day in court.
It's a different question, though, if they start an independent action, a new action in Indiana, and relying on Park Lane or some doctrine of collateral estoppel, but they couldn't rely, just take this judgment in Indiana and sue on it.
I wouldn't. I'd start a brand new action and plead collateral estoppel against him and say, you've had your day in court, we've litigated your liability.
It may be, but that would be in a new lawsuit.
Yes, it would.
But how about this judgment?
This judgment? The Minnesota judgment? The Minnesota judgment in Minnesota is worth $50,000 and no more.
Is it worth any more in Indiana? Is that judgment?
I can't answer that.
Say you
question.
Start a suit on that judgment in Indiana like you normally would to collect a judgment.
He shouldn't be able to, but I don't know the answer to that because of the very, should we say, unusual jurisdictional basis that we have here to begin with. If we were playing a true quasi in rem ball game, the answer to these questions would be all very easy. Obviously, a quasi in rem judgment isn't good for anything more than the asset which comprises the race. And that's all you've got to use to liquidate your judgment.
May I ask this question in this connection?
Yes, Mr. Justice Powell.
Assume that the plaintiff in this case, in order to protect himself against the possibility that Minnesota would not have taken jurisdiction, had simultaneously instituted a personal damage suit in Indiana, the site of the accident. Would that have changed the situation?
Well, he'd have, if he had commenced a lawsuit in Indiana prior to the running of the Indiana statute of limitations, of course it would have changed the situation that he would have a valid in personam action going for him in Indiana and wouldn't need a quasi in rem proceeding in Minnesota at all. But after the Indiana statute of limitations is run, he's foreclosed from doing that.
Well, he may have thought it more convenient to litigate in Minnesota, but just as an anchor to Wynwood, he may also have sued in Indiana, so that if his insurer paid $50,000 in Minnesota, the plaintiff still might recover the rest of that $1 million you mentioned in Indiana, if you had a solvent defendant. This was a 20-year-old young man.
That's right.
Presumably incapable of responding to further judgment. But what I was asking is, under Minnesota law, would the simultaneous institution of an in personam action in Indiana have ousted in rem jurisdiction in Minnesota?
Again, since there's no determinations by any courts in this area, I would be just giving you my expert opinion. I would think that the Minnesota court under those circumstances would give comedy to the Indiana action, which was an in personam thing, and hold their quasi in rem action in abeyance until the
Nobody knows
what the Minnesota courts would do in that area.
Mr. Adamson, where do you suppose the limitation imposed by the Supreme Court of Minnesota that this procedure is available only to residents of the forum state came from?
They told us in their opinion, I think it was the first Sobchak opinion, where Chief Justice Sharon made it clear that without the plaintiff's connection, we're using international shoe language now, without plaintiff's connection to the state of Minnesota,
by being a domicile there.
That's right, by being a resident citizen of the state of Minnesota, without plaintiff's connection with the state of Minnesota, Minnesota would lack sufficient contacts with the suit to justify jurisdiction. This is what the Minnesota Supreme Court said.
But the sufficient contacts is well, as you're submitting, has to do with the defendant, not with the plaintiff.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that to predicate the constitutional basis of this doctrine on the residency of plaintiffs and saying it's not available to non-residents raises another horrible constitutional problem. That is a denial of non-residents of the right of citizenship in the state of Minnesota. We slammed the courts closed to them as far as this is concerned. Again, this is not before the court, but it illustrates the problems we get into when we try to, I think, emasculate the Schaefer decision and go down this line.
Well, would the Minnesota court, under its present decision after the remand under Schaffner, say that a resident of Minnesota can sue a defendant in any other state anywhere?
The Supreme Court of Minnesota, in both of its decisions, held that a resident may sue a non-resident involving any tort which could occur anywhere in the world, providing he can get garnishment jurisdiction over the insurance company within the state of Minnesota. I haven't answered your question.
What I'm curious is, does the Minnesota law require any contacts on the part of the defendant with the state?
None whatsoever.
Except
through the vehicle of the fact that the happenstance that his insurer happens to do business in the state of Minnesota. I beg your pardon, sir?
Except that the defendant owned property there, i.e. his interest his in policy. This insurance policy.
What he owns is precisely the protection of an insurance policy, and what he owns is the promise of the insurance company to defend him against such suits as this.
That's right, and to
pay. It certainly is not just some chance property. It's something that's actually bought to defend him against suits.
But the point is, Your Honor, that as in Schaefer, the insurance contract itself is not the subject matter of the litigation. There's no quarrel about it. It's not even a Minnesota contract. It is there, just as the stock would have been in Schaefer, to satisfy a judgment rendered against those shareholders and directors.
Yeah, but nobody bought the stock in order to provide a way to respond to litigation.
That's what this insurance policy was
bought for, one of the reasons.
Let me live dangerously and suggest a hypothetical to you. Suppose we change one fact in Schaefer. Suppose instead of corporate stock, The plaintiff in Schaefer had garnished in Delaware a officers and directors liability insurance policy issued by some company out in Oregon or California, and written by a company that happened to do business in Delaware. I cannot read Schaefer as coming to an opposite result if that had been the case. Nobody was fighting about that insurance policy. Well, they were fighting about...
Suggesting that, that pre-Schaefer or pre-Schaefer, however you pronounce it, that this would have been all right?
Which would have been all right?
The Minnesota result.
Well, we were contending it was the wrong before this court decided Schaefer.
I know, but the way you depend on Schaefer, you'd think that it would have been quite proper before.
Well, the reason we're depending so on Schaefer is that, of course, it's an utterance of the highest court in this land in a quasi-in-rem jurisdiction case, which bears extreme parallels to our case.
I don't blame you, but even before Schaefer, your arguments sound like it would have been bad, would it? Only New York before.
Oh, you mean... is this doctrine of Sider versus Roth is what we're talking about now, the Minnesota garnishment rule and what have you, is that a bad thing before Schaefer?
Yes. Well,
it certainly was.
Under what? International shoe?
I would say under international shoe, the trend of the case law, as Mr. Justice Marshall so clearly pointed out, was all going in this direction, that this mechanical... You see, up until Schaefer, the underpinning of all of these Sider versus Roth cases was Harris versus Bump. Just that naked power over the property in the state. That's all you had to have, New York Court of Appeals said. That's all you had to have, the United States Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit said. And that's what was shot down in Schaefer. But I think it was bad before, and it certainly is bad now, in our judgment.
Mr. Adamson, on the Schaefer point, supposing instead of an insurance policy, the defendant had a bank account, and just over the years, they just kept $50,000 in the state, had no other contact with the state. Would you say that under Schaffner, the plaintiff could get jurisdiction, interim jurisdiction to the extent of $50,000?
Under Schaffner, if the bank account had nothing to do with this litigation, that the only purpose was to acquire jurisdiction and to collect the judgment, under Schaffner, he would have no right to garnish that bank account. None whatsoever, as I understand the Schaefer opinion.
But under Harris against Balk, he would.
Yes, sir, most definitely. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may.
Mr. Barkin?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The facts are simple in this case as far as how the accident happened and where it occurred. But I think we have to look at what Minnesota was doing after Sider versus Roth and that type of case started out of New York, which had to do with automobiles and automobile liability insurance. In 1969, Minnesota realized that in order to provide a forum for its residents, through the legislature, they did pass the garnishment statute, the 571.41, adding subdivision 2, where they definitely had in mind this type of case, such as Savchuk versus Rush. They felt there where there would be a policy of insurance between a defendant and the insurance company, where the defendant had proper notice and the plaintiff was a resident of the forum or of Minnesota, he could then bring the action. They even use terms called, and as the court knows, judgment, debtor, and defendant. Following that statute, the first time I believe that Minnesota actually looked at the statute was in Judge Neville's opinion in the Rentala case. And I think that goes to the heart of the matter here, is Judge Neville, and we have, and right in line with the Schaffer case, as far as saying for fundamental fairness and context, that really is the defendant getting due process under the statute, and he looked at it and said, yes, because the insurance company and the defendant and the plaintiff are actually, you have to look at all of that transaction in an automobile accident. You can't just isolate it on the defendant, such as we have in the Schaffer case. Judge Neville then felt the statute was constitutional. They've applied it, and they've applied it in Minnesota over the last 10 years. So when Savchuk moved to Minnesota, actually his parents or his father was transferred to Minnesota some year or so later after he moved after the accident, we received the case in our office. Actually, the form in Indiana, the statute of limitations had run, and of course the Minnesota statute has run now, because in 1974, when we obtained the garnishment and this procedure started, State Farm, and along with its defendant through the policy, has been bringing it before the courts. Now, the important part of the decisions in Minnesota and what we look to is the fact of the insurance company is the real interest, the real party in interest in the case. There's no question that from the time the accident happened, albeit in Indiana, the insurance company then comes in and calls the shots, if you please, from then on.
You agree that the defendant individual had no contact with the forum?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And isn't it something of an oversimplification to say that the insurance company comes in and calls the shots with the duty to settle, the duty to cooperate, and so forth? There is a constant possibility of an adverse relationship developing between the insured and the insurance company.
Well, maybe the choice of words calling the shot isn't correct to use that term, but the plaintiff, after the automobile accident occurs and the defendant gives notice to his insurance carrier, from that time on, myself, or as attorney for the plaintiff, would then only contact we have is the attorney really for the insurance company, even though he is representing the defendant through the policy. What I'm saying is that if there's going to be settlement discussions, it's going to be with the insurance company. And if the insurance company is going to settle, it's the insurance company. They select the counsel they're going to use to defend. They tell when it's going to be settled. They see whether or not it's going to court. The defendant, and especially in Minnesota, where the statute and the cases on the Supreme Court have stated only the $50,000 limit is involved.
So you never run into a case where the defendant individually hired his own lawyer because he felt the insurance company was refusing a reasonable offer of settlement and insisted that the insurance company settle where the insurance company is unwilling to settle?
Yes, in the bad, where there might be bad faith.
Or where there was a risk of a judgment beyond the amount of the coverage.
That may be true, Your Honor, too. Here, I think that's why the Minnesota court, the Supreme Court, and also the federal decisions, which there are three in Minnesota, have all stated that will comply with the minimum context and fair play and substantial justice, because you are limiting it to the $50,000. You are giving him notice to come in to defend. But it's this relationship that's so close between an insurance company and the defendant. And Schaffer, or I can't, Schaefer, whatever.
Mr. Hawkon, I'm not sure I follow your argument. Are you saying that this relationship between the insurance company and the other parties is what controls in this case? Suppose the driver of the automobile that is alleged to have been negligent had been a Rockefeller.
Had been what?
Had been a Rockefeller. Many millions of dollars could have paid any deficiency judgment. Would you have dealt, if you'd had the case originally, or with the insurance company, or with counsel for the wealthy defendant who could pay a $1 million judgment? I don't understand whether you're saying Minnesota has jurisdiction in this case only because the only party likely to respond to any judgment anywhere is the insurance company.
Well, it's to get jurisdiction is, we feel, is proper because the insurance company is the one doing business in Minnesota. It's the number one insurance carrier writing liability insurance in Minnesota. So we look to get jurisdiction in Minnesota for the resident of Minnesota. So we would look to bring him into the forum where the insurance company is doing business controlled by the state of Minnesota. They have their benefits, the insurance company in Minnesota. They can be regulated by Minnesota. And we would look to the insurance company to the extent of the policy for the defendant.
But if the statute of limitations had not run in Indiana in the case that I put to you, you would have had to advise your client to sue in Indiana, wouldn't you?
If there would be an unlimited resources, depending on his injuries.
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Hawkon, do you agree that if the insurance company should go bankrupt, you could not, and assume you got a judgment of $50,000, which I guess is the policy limit, you could not collect the judgment from the defendant individually?
Well, I'd agree to that because of the
Quasi and rem,
it's a race that's the insurance policy. That
would you also agree that the individual defendant could defy any court order and not risk contempt if he just didn't show up and just didn't respond to any notice or anything like that?
I'd agree to that.
Yeah.
And if you got a judgment for $1 million in Minnesota and the policy limits were 50, you couldn't enforce the $1 million judgment personally against the defendant in Indiana?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, we've agreed to be bound by the policy limits by stipulation following Judge
Neville. But I take it you haven't agreed not to use this judgment as binding on him in a separate suit in Indiana.
Well, we have. We've agreed that this will be our lawsuit, the $50,000 in Minnesota.
Well, I know in Minnesota, but what if you went to... Have you agreed not to sue him for anything in addition in Indiana?
Yes.
Didn't you sue originally for more than $50,000?
Well, it was sued, and then it was amended to bring it within the $50,000.
Brought it originally for $125,000 or $150,000, as I recall.
There was $125,000, I think, plus the 110% following the garnishment statute. Right. Then, after State Farm answered the supplemental, well, first they answered that they owed no debt. Then, under another statute in that same chapter, we brought him into the lawsuit on a supplemental complaint. Then we agreed to limit our lawsuit to $50,000, and that pretty much now is the Minnesota law.
Yeah, but how did you agree not to sue for more in Indiana? Let's assume you got your $50,000 judgment in Minnesota.
That's correct.
Now, in what form did you agree not to sue for more in Indiana in a separate suit?
Well, we stipulated, and following the Minnesota law, you would have to agree to the $50,000 judgment in Minnesota and that you wouldn't be suing him.
What? Is that the consequence of your stipulation?
Well, it is, because we reduced also.
Just because you can only collect 50 in Minnesota, why does that mean that you're barred from suing for the balance of what you claim your injury was in Indiana?
Well, we've agreed to it in this case.
Of course, in this case, you weren't giving up anything because the statute had run in Indiana.
Well, they both run now, of course, so we don't know what.
But when obviously things came to you, the statute can't run in Indiana?
Yes, Your Honor.
The statute is longer in Minnesota?
The statute is run in Minnesota also. It was 6 years.
I know, yeah, but when you instituted the first action.
The statute in Minnesota had not run.
What about in Indiana?
It had run.
So the statute in Minnesota was longer in a personal injury case than it is in Indiana.
That's correct, yes. 6 years in Minnesota and 2 years in Indiana.
And also you have the doctrine of comparative negligence rather than contributory negligence.
There. That's correct, Your Honor. Right. And we don't have the guest statute.
Right.
And if you find a statement of longer statute of limitation, you file another suit now, essentially.
Well, we're saying that, at least from our standpoint, that we'd only take a case where a plaintiff is a legitimate resident of Minnesota. He did live there for some 5 years.
And now he's in Pennsylvania.
That's correct, Your Honor. But he was married, and I'd say that 5 years afterwards, plus it's at the time he brings a lawsuit, and I think in this day and age, to hold some young man that had business opportunity elsewhere to live in Minnesota.
And also a favorable statute.
Well, I don't know. I have to say that I don't know if he knew that because we didn't have the case when he moved and sometime afterwards. But it's for those reasons that I think it's different than the Schaffer case where.
Well, how does the state of Minnesota's law apply to this accident?
Through the insurance company. We feel that in, like Schaffer, where the stock and that had nothing to do with the underlying action or the litigation whatsoever, and they wouldn't have an interest. Here, I think...
You're really saying it doesn't matter whether it was an accident or not, aren't you?
I'm saying that in Minnesota, N can follow the Schaffer case with no problem because it's a particular statute that the Minnesota courts or the legislature at first recognized and saying when it comes to automobiles and automobile liability insurance, this will be the law. And we can still follow Schaffer and International Shoe because they're looking at those cases in Minnesota and saying there have minimum contacts have been met. But you can't take the insurance company in Iceland.
You mean the Schaffer case as construed by the Minnesota court?
That's true, Your Honor.
Right. Well, now I'm saying
Mr. Borkin, did your client have accident insurance? He was injured, or do you know, or is there anything in the case to indicate? He was injured as a guest, is that it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he suffered some injuries, and he had some medical expenses, I suppose. Is that
do you
just think that's irrelevant?
Well, it would be for quasi-rem jurisdiction, but I think that they, I can't remember.
Mr. Borkin, can I ask you a question about the assumption on the policy terms? It's critical, I guess, to quasi-rem jurisdiction that there be an obligation of the insurance company to defend the insured. Supposing they change their policy language to provide they agree to defend the insured in any forum in which personal jurisdiction can be obtained over the insured, but they would have no obligation to defend when the only basis for jurisdiction was a quasi-in-rem theory, then you couldn't hold them, could you?
No, I don't think Minnesota would allow them to write insurance, State Farm, possibly, on that kind of grounds.
Well, but maybe Indiana would let them write, because some states have considered this kind of litigation and decided not to adopt this kind of statute.
That's correct.
And in those states, I assume they would permit, for say Indiana, might well permit that kind of policy to be written and issued in Indiana, if that's what it said. I take it that would destroy the basis for quasi and rem jurisdiction.
It probably would.
It rests entirely on the terms of the contract between the insurance company and the insured.
Well, plus, I don't think you leave out the plaintiff. I mean, we realize that under the Schaffer case, you're looking to contest.
Yeah, but there's no duty to defend. The mere fact the plaintiff lives in Minnesota certainly isn't a sufficient basis.
That's correct. But the main purpose for obviously having liability insurance is not only to cover yourself, but if you have to answer in damages to someone you...
The defendant would have no risk if he's not subject to personal jurisdiction.
Well, he has no risk in this case because he's not going to give up anything. The insurance company is the only one possible that's going to give anything up. The defendant will give up nothing.
I understand. Yes.
But if he were uninsured, he would have no risk in Minnesota either.
Well, he'd have no risk, but save it to say that we... It's rare, if at all, if we would take a case where the defendant is uninsured.
Well, I wasn't asking whether you would take the case. We were talking about risk, the defendant's risk. If he had never entered the state of Minnesota, all the physical action takes place in Indiana, he could be uninsured and still have no risk in Minnesota.
That's true.
Well, that's true about all in rem and quasi in rem jurisdiction. If the defendant doesn't own real or personal property in the jurisdiction, there cannot be in rem or quasi in rem jurisdiction.
Correct, Your Honor. And then that's, we feel it was the insurance policy, but it's, we feel it in, and that's the Minnesota Supreme Court and the federal court through Minnesota has interpreted, is that it's the insurance policy and the contact it has with its own defendant, that's different or unique, what have you. Sure. But still, you can apply Schaffer versus Heitner and International Shoe, and that's being fair to the defendant. But you can't isolate the defendant from his insurance company.
And that Morgan, in the original papers, the insurance company took the position that the debt was zero, because it was a contingent liability.
Right.
They never did deny that they had an obligation to defend, though, did they?
No. They never denied that.
Nor an obligation to pay, a conditional obligation to pay.
That's correct, Your Honor. We feel that there's an obligation to defend and there's an obligation to pay. And the fact that the statute is there so that it takes away from the contingency that Mr. Justice Stevens talked about. The fact in Minnesota, you even have interrogatories that can find out the policy limits so that what you're dealing with. And when, say, 90% of the cases, at least in Minnesota, Mr. Adamson and his firm will be on that case if State Farm Insurance is the policy writer for the insured. Still, if they have the form nonconvenience statute as far as if the court feels more witnesses are located in a different area. Answer any question the court has.
Apparently, no further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Do you have anything further, Mr. Adamson?
Very briefly, I listened to my friend, and I've not heard him touch at all upon what is, of course, the keystone language, I believe, of the Schaffer opinion. And that language is, if a direct assertion of personal jurisdiction over the defendant would violate the Constitution, it would seem that an indirect assertion of the jurisdiction should be equally impermissible. We have an attempt for an indirect assertion of jurisdiction here. To me, it seems it would be equally impermissible. We therefore ask that the judgment below be reversed and the matter be remanded for the entry of a judgment of dismissal.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Perrin against...